I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. We get to talk for an hour about my favorite subject, food, and how it can have a tremendous impact on your personal health and the health of your family. And we have a wonderful guest today, Dr. Neil Barnard, and he has just done so many wonderful things. I'm going to read a very brief bio, but this man has just done incredible things in the last quarter century. He's a physician, clinical researcher, adjunct associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University of Medicine, and principal investigator of a major study on diet and type 2 diabetes funded by the National Institutes of Health. He is the author of numerous books and has hosted a popular public television program on diabetes. He is the founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM. Dr. Barnard is also president of the Cancer Project, a nonprofit organization advancing cancer prevention and survival through nutrition, education, and research. Dr. Barnard, welcome.
Yes, hello.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And like I was just saying, you're really an amazing person doing so many wonderful things for people and the planet, and I can't thank you enough for that.
Well, that's nice of you to say. Thank you. It's certainly a team effort. The things that we're doing are done by a whole group of people and many other people like Dean Ornish and John McDougall and Colin Campbell and Caldwell Esselstyn. And so many others are speaking with a similar voice and doing just tremendous work.
Yeah, it definitely takes a big village.
It sure does. But what you said in the introduction is really right, that people used to think of food as, well, it's something you pick because it tastes good. They didn't really realize that foods, if you choose them the right way, can act like medicines, and all the side effects are good ones. So if you eat in the right way, you lose weight, but your diabetes gets better, and your cholesterol falls, and your blood pressure improves, all at the same time. So it really is true.
Now, of course, you have to be careful there, because our government has not necessarily rules that serve the public all the time, but we can't call food medicine, can we?
Well, perhaps I can, but I don't know if everybody does. What I mean by that is this.
No, I'm not knocking you. It's just I know that there are rules that if you call, we can't call food a medicine, because then it has to go through all kinds of other things and with regulation.
Sure.
And things like that. It's crazy.
Here's what I'm thinking. As you mentioned in the introduction, NIH, the National Institutes of Health, funded my team to test a new dietary approach for diabetes. And up until now, in fact today, if you went to see a doctor and the doctor diagnosed diabetes, the doctor would say to you, the problem is you've got too much sugar in your blood, that sugar is glucose, and so I'm going to write a prescription that helps bring down your blood sugar. And I'd like you to change your diet, but the doctor does not have any hope that you're really going to follow the diet.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor also doesn't believe that if you do follow the diet, that it'll help save you from medication, because diets are just too weak. So we tested a different kind of diet. And it was based on the idea that the people who have the least diabetes on the planet are the people who are probably eating in a better way. And so those would be people who follow vegetarian diets, or if you look in Asia where people eat diets based on rice and lots of vegetables, relatively little in the way of animal products, that those are good patterns for us to look to. And so when we implemented this kind of diet, throwing out the animal products, keeping oils low, keeping sugar low, we found that the effects were more powerful, not only than other diets, but more powerful than oral diabetes medications. And people's blood sugars improved, their cholesterols came down, they lost weight, their blood pressure improved. All of these things got better at the same time. So I think of it as being like a medication.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that doctors will, instead of saying, well, a medication should be your first line of defense and diet is alternative, I would turn that around and say, we got to this stage with a bad diet. Let's use a healthier diet to see if we can turn things around. And if you need medicines on top of that, so be it. But many people will not.
Can we underline what you said a few lines back, that the results of this study, people had better results with their diabetes than with any medication?
Right. Better results with a diet than they did with a typical oral diabetes medication.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean, when we looked at the people who didn't make any changes in their exercise or in their medications or anything else, if you looked at the improvement in their blood sugar control, it was the test that we use is something called hemoglobin A1C, and this will not be on the test for today's listeners. But the idea, what hemoglobin A1C is, if I stick a needle in your arm and I measure your blood glucose, that only tells me your blood sugar control at the moment I do the test. Mm-hmm. And it's blood glucose is going up and down and up and down from minute to minute. So researchers devised a new test called hemoglobin A1C a number of years ago, and it gives a good overall average for your blood sugar control, and the number is supposed to be below 7. And our people averaged around 8 when they started, some as high as 10, which is terrible. And what we showed, if you take a typical oral drug, it will drop your hemoglobin A1C by about a half a point to maybe a point. We showed with this, with the diet that we devised, the average person dropped their hemoglobin A1C by 1.2 or 1.3 points, which is stronger than drugs, stronger than other diets. And we had some people drop it as much as 3 points, 4 points, just dramatic. And we've had doctors be incredulous that a diet could be this powerful. And the amazing thing is that we're eating simple things like beans and vegetables and fruits and whole grains. And it's important to eat the right things, and it's important to avoid certain things too. So anyway, that's a long-winded answer to a really good question.
Doctors can be incredulous, and I've sat with many of them where we've had quite passionate debates about what they're doing. And hopefully, I think it's changing with the younger doctors and their realization of the impact diet can have on health and prevention of chronic diseases. But it can be very frustrating. You know, people, you're probably aware of this, but people listen. When it comes to health, they listen to their doctors and to celebrities.
Yeah, and the doctor learned what he knows about, or he or she knows about nutrition from a celebrity in a magazine.
There we go.
Sitting at the pool, and you know, his or her spouse says, "Hey, honey, did you see this?" And so that's kind of their source of nutrition information. Because I'm kidding a little bit, but it's unfortunately true that nutrition is underemphasized in medical school. We're getting better, but we're not where we need to be yet.
But this is where PCRM comes along, because you have phenomenal information, and I invite everyone to visit PCRM.org. There's just so much great information there. But you also are getting a sexier image because you're including more celebrities that are spreading the message as well, and that's good marketing appeal.
I'm happy to say that a lot of people in Hollywood have supported us, particularly in our campaign for healthier kids. Children are going to school in the morning, and their lunchtime meal is served through a federal program. And the Child Nutrition Act is in Congress right now. And in the next several weeks, Congress is going to decide what kids will be eating in school. And up until now, schools have been used as dumping grounds for
mm-hmm.
unhealthy foods.
Mm-hmm.
If farmers produce too much beef, well, it ends up in the schools. If they have too much in the way of dairy products, too much cheese, suddenly kids are eating cheeseburgers, cheese pizza, not because anyone thinks they need another cheese serving, but because federal law requires the school lunch program to be used as a disposal mechanism for agricultural surpluses. And that is a cruel thing to do to children, particularly at a time when 1 in 3 is now overweight, 1 in 5 has an abnormal cholesterol level as children. So Congress is now debating how much they really want to improve that, and we are pushing very hard for vegetarian options in every school. I'm talking about vegan options, so that a child does not have to have meat for breakfast, meat for lunch, meat for dinner. I mean, they should be having meals that don't have meat and dairy products in them as part of their routine, and I would say that the healthiest kids of all are the ones who stick to a plant-based diet all the time.
My understanding of the school lunch program is that it's very difficult to provide healthy options because of the way it's configured. Now, I know there are commodity foods that are healthier than some, but children have to have milk, dairy milk, in order to get the subsidy per child.
That's right, and I strongly feel that that should change. It was understandable during the Depression when there were a lot of kids who really were hungry. Today that has changed, where kids are not so much underfed as they're undernourished. Many poor kids deal with obesity because they're getting plenty of calories, they're getting plenty of grease, but they're getting it in the form of cheese or meat or fried foods, fatty foods, as opposed to vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains, which really ought to be the most affordable things, but are unfortunately sometimes in rather short supply.
That's not just true of children, it's also true of adults where we're undernourished.
We are, and if you look at what has happened, in May I published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition a review of what's happened to our dietary habits over the last century, starting in 1909. And it's amazing, the average American has increased the annual meat intake by about 75 pounds. I'm talking about one person over the course of the year eats 75 pounds more meat now than they did 100 years ago. About 30 pounds more cheese, maybe 30 pounds or so more sugar. And then we think, well, why are people heavy? Is it because they're not exercising enough? The change in exercise is not enough to account for it. It's the input side of it. And it's not just sodas. People are ready to blame sodas, and frankly, they're junk food. But the problem, if you look at a fast food restaurant, what are they selling? They're selling meat in the form of burgers and chicken nuggets, fish sandwiches. They're topping it with cheese in amounts that people never used to eat before. And then the sugar is in the soda on the side. And that is a recipe for obesity. And as soon as that becomes the norm, then we're going to have a heavy population. And obviously that's exactly what we've got.
It's not surprising to me.
You know, but if you look back in time, there was a time when people knew what beans were, or what lentil soup was, or what pea soup was, and when you could have vegetables and things. And in fact, when people were not as economically advantaged as they are now, people ate things out of their gardens. And so you're not going to be slaughtering a cow in your backyard for the most part. So people would eat beans and vegetables, fruits, and so forth in much greater quantity. I should say much more of a proportion of their diet compared to now, where cheese and meat have really come in. Now, I have to say, I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota. My grandpa was a cattle rancher. I know that, you know, they're good people who make these products. Mm-hmm. But as time goes on, just as we learned that lung cancer comes from tobacco, we now know that heart disease, colon cancer, diabetes come from a meaty, cheesy diet. And medicine, in American medicine, we've slowly but surely come to realize that. And it's important for us to get that message out to people who still think that these diseases are mainly genetic. They are not. They are mainly related to what we're eating and what we're feeding our families.
Can we talk a little bit about growth hormones? You have a great article on your website on growth hormones, and there is an article running around the Internet right now that John Robbins wrote recently about some information in China about baby girls starting to develop as infants. And there's some thought that there's way too much of the growth hormone in the dairy in China, but also we have issues with it here. And your article in particular was talking about how shorter men have less prostate cancer. There seems to be some sort of correlation about growth hormones enabling us to grow bigger and faster, but then there's a downside.
Yes. There are all different facets to this. One area is the growth hormone itself is marketed by pharmaceutical companies, and it's sold to, well, through pediatricians, to parents who want to make their kids taller. And we have been very, very concerned about that because there's a downside to it. The other side of this is that our diets act rather like a growth hormone in the following way. If a calf nurses, the calf is getting sugar and protein and fat in the cow's milk. The calf is also getting hormones and growth factors that cause the calf to be able to grow very rapidly, and then the calf can ultimately start grazing, and then the calf no longer drinks milk. Well, human beings learned about 6,000 years ago to make cows stand still. And when that happened, we could be like the calf. We could have cow's milk for ourselves, which Mother Nature has never gotten used to the idea of humans drinking cow's milk, the milk from another species, but also it defies the weaning process. No adult animal drinks any kind of milk except for, obviously, humans have figured out how to do this. The problem is it has the same effect, that in your body, just as growth hormone triggers the production of other compounds, like insulin-like growth factor that causes growth, that causes cancer cells to grow, drinking milk does the same thing. And that is true whether it is a chemically treated milk, or I guess I should say a hormone-related milk, where the farmer is injecting growth hormone into the cow. It's also true in organically produced milk.
That's a really important point.
Yeah. So in other words, if you go to the health food store and you get one that says, this is from a happy cow who is eating only organic, first of all, much of that is just fantasy. But the cleanest cow is producing milk for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to make a calf grow fast. And if you're an adult human, rapid growth means what? Growth of cancer cells. And there's, particularly with regard to prostate cancer in men, there's a very strong relationship with milk consumption. Men who don't drink milk have a much lower risk. Men who drink a lot of milk have a much higher risk. So milk should really be thought of.
Milk is not a good food.
Well, it's a really great food if you're an infant and if it came from your mom.
Right.
But otherwise, no. Yeah.
When we talk about vegetarian diets, a lot of us vegetarians and vegans have heard ad nauseum the response that we get, you know, where do you get your protein, where do you get your calcium? But there seem to be a few new myths that are added to that list, and that's soy. A lot of people are concerned about its safety.
Yeah, and I think people raised some good questions, and luckily those questions have been pretty thoroughly addressed. And I think those questions came in two directions. One is the dairy industry wasn't, at first, the dairy industry wasn't so happy to have soy milk kind of pushing cow's milk off the shelves. However, the dairy industry, many of them have bought up soy milk manufacturers now.
That's right.
So when you go into the grocery,
join them.
Well, that's what they're doing. They're diversifying, and so that means you'll see cartons of Silk and other soy milks in very prominent places in the dairy case now. So maybe that's to the good. But the other thing is soybeans, like all, every bean, every plant, every animal, has hormones or various other compounds that circulate around and communicate from one part of the organism to another part. And soybeans are no exception. And people identified compounds called isoflavones that looked in some ways similar to estrogens, to human female sex hormones. And at first they thought, well, this is going to be good because maybe that will have an anti-cancer effect. And others said, no, maybe it'll be bad. Maybe it will increase the risk of cancer. Well, the jury is in. And here's the way the numbers look. If a girl consumes soy products, like soy milk or tofu, on a daily basis during her adolescence while the breast tissue is forming, her risk of breast cancer is reduced by about 30% compared to girls who don't know about soy, soy helps prevent breast cancer, is what the research is showing. And then the next question was, well, what if you got cancer already? Could soy help you? And the answer is yes. There was a study of about 5,000 women, all had breast cancer. Those who consumed soy products regularly had about a 30% less risk of dying of their cancer and about a 30% less risk of any kind of recurrence. So soy is not the silver bullet, but it certainly appears to be safe and clearly has some advantages. On the other hand, if you don't like it or you don't want it, you don't need it. It's entirely optional. But for people who enjoy it, it's very versatile, turns into all kinds of great things, and appears to be not only safe but beneficial.
Thank you for that. I like my soy in lots of things. It's really an amazing food. But like you said, if you don't like it, you don't have to eat it, and people should like what they eat.
Sure. Well, you know, for a lot of folks, I grew up in North Dakota. We had a lot of soy, but we fed it to cows. And we sold it to other people who fed it to their pigs or to their chickens. And that's that's all we did was soy. I never had tofu or tempeh or these wonderful things, and I'm embarrassed to say, you know, when I left Fargo in adulthood and I moved to Washington, D.C. to go to medical school, and I suddenly started to discover the world of healthy eating.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, not only the simple things like Italian plum tomatoes and fresh basil that could make a wonderful spaghetti sauce, and Chinese foods and Japanese foods, but Thai foods and Vietnamese foods and all so many things that now I follow an entirely vegan diet, and my diet is so much more varied and so much more delightful than it was when I was a meat eater in North Dakota.
We're going to get to the delicious part of this later and your cookbook, but I still have some more health questions and issues I want to talk about. There seems to be some sort of block that people have when it comes to changing their diet and eating healthy, and I haven't quite figured it out. But one of the things that you mention in the book is, I don't know how many decades it was when people decided they should be eating a lower-fat milk or using lower-fat milk products, when we would drink those products, they tasted watery compared to the full-fat milk. But then over time, if we had full-fat milk, it tasted heavy and oily, and we had gotten accustomed to the lighter-fat milk product. It happened to me, and I remember talking about it with lots of people. But and yet, we all went with it because that's what was out there and that's what was recommended. And there's all of, and I don't even know if that was a good thing. but there are all these other wonderful things that we can do with healthy plant foods, and people are wary of them.
Well, I think it's biological. If you go to Kenya or Tanzania, and if you look at a baby chimp, the little baby chimpanzee goes off and picks a berry or a leaf, and the baby's older sister or mother will flick it away and not let the infant eat it, because you could be poisoned by some new food. Mm. And we have the same kind of reaction where we are naturally conservative when it comes to foods, and you don't eat something that is not part of your culture because you could be poisoned. So somebody brings to you this nice big red strawberry, and you've never seen a strawberry before, so you're naturally going to wrinkle your brow and go, I'm not sure. People are that way with every new food, and there's a survival value to it. The problem is the strawberry is nutritious. In fact, it's better than the Spam sandwich that you had for lunch. So when we learn new things, I often give exactly what you described, this analogy of whole milk to skim milk. When people first taste skim milk, it's very watery, but then if they just stick with it, their tastes adjust. And after about 3-4 weeks, they're totally used to it, and if they go back and taste whole milk again, it's greasy, it tastes, it's like cream, it's like paint almost.
Yep.
And if you lighten your whole diet, it doesn't seem quite enough for the first few days, but then you start to adapt, your tastes start to prefer it, and after about 3 weeks, you go back and have a double bacon cheeseburger, and it is not the joyful experience that you remembered. So.
No, it isn't. I've been there.
Yep.
Now, is part of your understanding of this people's behavior with food, does that come from your psychiatric background as a psychiatrist in your early medical days?
Yeah. Are you saying is part of my view of this based on my psychiatric training?
Yeah.
I think it's only half medicine. I think half, when I'm doing our diabetes work, for example, half of it is the biological side. The other half is all behavior. And it's how do you help a person, and not just food changes. Let's say it's quitting smoking.
Mm-hmm.
A person knows that if they quit smoking, their risk of lung cancer is going to drop. They're going to feel so much better. But they're addicted to these things. They don't know how to break away. One of the keys that we use is a short-term focus. I never say to a person, don't think now. I never say to a person, you have to plan what you're going to have for the rest of your life. We focus just on the short term. And at PCRM, we have a new program that we call our Kickstart. I don't know if you've had a chance to try this, but it's a 3-week online program. It doesn't cost a cent. You log on our website, pcrm.org, and what we do is we send you an email, an encouraging email and recipes and menus. We send them to you every day so that you feel like you're part of a community, but you also know that it's only 3 weeks. So you're doing a vegan diet for 3 weeks, and if you don't like it, you just stop. But if you like it, you can stick with it. So if anybody wants to do this, the next one is starting September 6th, and it's called the Kickstart Program, and you just go to pcrm.org, sign up. We already have 65,000 people have already gone through it. We have 10,000 signed up for the next one. It is so much fun, and I hope people will join us.
Yeah, well, it's a great thing, and I think one of the positive things about a program like that is when someone signs up, they're committing themselves. But like you said, it's a short time frame, so it just feels manageable.
Yeah, I think that's right. It also is social. You know, you can have everybody in your office do it or everybody in your family. And a husband and wife, they'll look at each other and they'll say, do we want to do this? They're not so sure. Well, do we want to buy this car? Let's do a test drive. Do we want to try this diet? Let's do a test drive of this, too. And 3 weeks is just enough time to see how it feels. And that's why the Kickstart is a three-week program. So it's so much fun for people. We've gotten tremendous feedback. And as you know, you were mentioning celebrities earlier, celebrities help us with it, like Alicia Silverstone and Mary Lou Henner and many, many others. Every day we have a new celebrity leader. So it's fun, I have to say.
There's a rumor going around the Internet. I don't know if it's true yet, but there's been all this big buzz about Chelsea Clinton's wedding and how she's a vegan and offered all of these different vegan options at her wedding. And something I read today was that Bill Clinton lost over 20 pounds following a non-dairy vegetarian diet in order to lose weight for his daughter's wedding.
Yes, it's more than a rumor.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Huge.
Well, you know, the times have arrived, and the research. You know, when I first heard of Dean Ornish showing that a plant-based diet, along with other healthy lifestyle changes like not smoking, could help people to actually open up their coronary arteries. That was amazing to me, but you know, that was 20 years ago. And it's now abundantly clear that if a person has heart disease or some weight to lose or a cholesterol problem or blood pressure problem, getting away from meat and getting away from dairy products, that's the first thing we should do. And just as it took time for the non-smoking message to get through, it's taking time for people to understand that animal products are not good for their health. But it's abundantly clear, and people from all walks of life are starting to embrace that message and put it to work. And I'm here in Washington, D.C. We have members of Congress who are going the same direction. And obviously in Hollywood, it's very, very trendy, of course, to be vegan now. And it's a good trend. And it's to the extent that the next generation embraces it, they'll be healthier.
Well, I was really glad to hear about Bill Clinton. I remember when he had his heart attack. He had heart issues. I forget
right.
Exactly what, but I remember Dr. McDougall writing open letters to him, telling him to change his diet.
Well, you saw many, many people who live in a very stressful life and a very busy life, and also in today's society, we have complete access to basically any kind of food that you want to eat, including all kinds of unhealthy foods. Everybody's at risk, and so. Whether people are a former president or if they are in a very different situation, people are at risk for health problems nowadays. And my message is it is never too late to make this change, and my job as a doctor is to try to make it easy.
Can we talk a little bit about the Cancer Project?
Yes, you bet. The Cancer Project is one of our programs. And the idea is that in addition to whatever other diagnostic procedures or treatments a person may get, they ought to start thinking about what they have been eating and how they can improve that. And I should hasten to say that whenever a person has cancer, they often feel a sense of guilt or blame that maybe they've been doing all the wrong things. And we set all that aside. We focus only on what can we do from here on out, and we focus on the biology of it. And it turns out that when people follow plant-based diets, they're not only can this help prevent cancer, but it can also improve survival from cancer. We don't have as much data on this as we like, but there have been more than enough studies to show that it makes a lot of sense to get the animal products out of the diet. And if you can do that way before the cancer is ever diagnosed, so much the better. But if a person has already got a diagnosis, it's never too late to change.
Well, I really support this project, and I it comes from a personal level. I went through ovarian cancer a few years ago, and I was an anomaly because I had been on a vegan diet for almost two decades before that, but it wasn't until I was 30 years old that I switched to a vegan diet, and although I'll never know what caused my problems, I have some theories. What I decided to do is get my diet up a notch. And although I thought I was already on a pretty healthy vegan diet, I started green juicing and really being more careful, getting more of the nutrients and immune-boosting nutrients into my diet and less of the fluff. And it's helped me. I feel great. I look great. And I know that it really made a difference.
You know, I think you've said something really important. Some people who haven't they really haven't started making diet changes yet, they might think of a vegan diet as being very extreme. And they pretty soon, once they actually try it and get used to it, they pretty soon come to realize it's not extreme at all. You're going out to dinner and you might be having a glass of wine and a salad and a big plate of spaghetti, but instead of meat sauce, it's a chunky tomato sauce with fresh basil and mushrooms in it. And, I mean, it's not a lot different from what you're eating before. I think of a vegan diet, meaning a diet that doesn't have animal products, not as the extreme end, but as the beginning. And once you've gotten away from the animal products and so forth and keeping the oils low, then which way do you go? Should we have more raw food, for example, and more juices and things? And many people would say that's a really healthy way, and I think there's a lot of evidence that that's true. And then other people might say, let's go macrobiotic, which a lot of, say, brown rice. Cooked vegetables and so forth, and maybe less fruit, more vegetables. I don't know exactly if one of these ways is better than the other, but if a person is still at the point where they haven't even given up animal products, then they're not really taking themselves seriously. So once we walk through that door and we're figuring out what the plant world can do for us, there's so many different ways to go, and that's where I think our culinary journey will start.
Yeah, it's really important. I'm so grateful that I was on this path to begin with because I'm absolutely convinced if I hadn't been vegan, I wouldn't be here, that the disease would have taken over a long time ago. Of course, you know, I don't have any proof of that, but that's just the way I feel. But there are just so many reasons, not just cancer, but all the chronic diseases benefit from this healthy diet.
And I often see people who say, well, it's too late for me. I had a man who was in our diabetes study who had had diabetes for about 20 years. And when you've had diabetes for a long period of time, it starts attacking, it attacks the blood vessels throughout the body. And that can mean something called neuropathy, where you get this terrible pain in your feet. And it doesn't just affect you physically, it affects your mood. Life is just not worth living anymore. Night after night, he had to put up with this terrible pain in his feet, and you just don't see the world getting better. Well, he began the vegan diet. His blood sugar started improving. His insulin doses started dropping and dropping and dropping. And then one day he told me his neuropathy was gone, and I said, let me make sure I understand.
Well,
you know, you've had this problem unremitting for all this time, and now since you've been on this diet, your neuropathy is a lot better. He said, I didn't say it was better. It's gone.
Gone.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I followed him for years after that, never came back. And you know, so many people believe that the pain in their joints of arthritis cannot get better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for some people, maybe it won't get better. But for so many people, when they get away from, say, dairy products, which are a common trigger for arthritis, their pain goes away. That was a book I wrote called Foods That Fight Pain a number of years ago to give people some insights into that. So it's never too late. I don't mean to say that diet is perfect. It's not. Some people who follow a really healthy diet will still get sick, and some people who follow a terrible diet stay healthy. And life isn't exactly fair.
That's right.
But it's really, really great to have it on your side.
Well, the thing is, there's no 100% promise of anything, but the thing on this healthy plant-based diet is that it's going to be good for so many things. So it may or may not address one particular thing, but it's going to benefit so many things in your health life.
It really does, and people often don't expect it. Another person in our diabetes study, his name was Vance. He was a policeman in Washington, and Vance's father was dead by age 30, and Vance himself was 31 when he was diagnosed with diabetes, came in to see us several years later. We put him on the vegan diet, and he loved it because he didn't have to count carbohydrate grams. He didn't have to count portion size. However much, if he wanted chili, he could have as much of it as he wanted as long as it was a vegan chili or any other food. He did really well. He lost about 60 pounds. His blood sugar control came down into the normal range, and his doctor stopped his medicine. And it was just the most amazing thing in the world. But when I was asking him for his permission to tell his story in an interview like this one, he said, make sure you tell people about ED. He had erectile dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a new marriage. He was a young guy. And a lot of people with diabetes are impotent, to use the old
mm-hmm.
word for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about 5 or 6 months into the study, his erectile dysfunction got better.
Woo-hoo!
And, you know, these are things that people really kind of thought were not going to change. I think one day I'm going to write a new book called The Vegan Sex Power Diet, and we'll really get people going this direction.
Yeah, or at least you could have some commercials on television right after those Viagra commercials.
Yeah, thanks. Save the $10 on the pill and just go out and buy some beans and spinach and healthy foods. The thing about it is the male sexual anatomy is a hydraulic system where you need good blood supply for it to work. And the blood supply is compromised in people who eat meat and cheese and other animal products on a daily basis, and you get them out of the diet, and as Dean Ornish showed, the arteries open up again, and the blood flow is restored. And so it's good for the heart, but it's also good for every other part of you, too.
People are really confused about diet because they hear all different kinds of things, those little sound bites on the evening news, and people keep going back to believing that, okay, red meat isn't good, they're eating less or they're not eating it, but they're eating a lot of chicken and certainly fish.
Yeah, people have been, and I think it's really marketing. The idea is that fish have omega-3 fatty acids, the so-called good fats, and so you should be eating it, especially the fatty fish like salmon. That's what people have heard. But what they don't realize is that most of the fat in salmon and in any other fish is not omega-3.
Hmm.
It's much of it between, maybe 15% or perhaps even as high as 30% in some types. It's saturated fat. That's the type that you think of as in bacon or sausage, the kind that increases your cholesterol. And the omega-3 part is only between maybe 15 and 30%, and all the rest is various kinds of unnecessary fat. And that fat is very fattening. Any kind of fat, including fish fat, has 9 calories in every gram of it. And so when people have a big salmon thing, those are people who have trouble maintaining their weight because the fatty fish that they're eating is contributing this huge load of calories. And the reason, of course, is a chicken stores calories as chicken fat. A fish stores calorie as fish fat. A cow stores calories as cow fat. You're eating their calorie storage organ, and then we're somehow surprised that we're getting fat ourselves.
There's a lot of different things that you talk about in the introduction of this book before it gets to the yummy, delicious recipes, which I want to highlight in a moment. But one of the things I think you talk about is moderation is not the word you use, but it's the word that I'm going to use. And the paragraph starts, can I have a little bit of cheese or maybe chicken every now and then? And you caution against this.
Yes. I do. I think it's like moderation in smoking.
There are two,
moderation is the idea of moderation in all things.
Mm-hmm.
That's sensible for healthy things. You want broccoli, but you don't want only broccoli. You want to moderate it so you have other things too. You want to, if you're a, if you want to do well in mathematics, you should study mathematics, but not only mathematics. You want to do other things, too. But you don't moderate your intake of cigarettes, heroin, cocaine. These things are toxic, and in small amounts, they're still toxic. So moderation should only apply to good things. If a person switches from beef to chicken, or they're eating small amounts, I can tell you their cholesterol level is really not going to fall very much. They're not going to really lose weight. Get away from the things that made us sick, and we're going to do much better.
Yeah, I personally believe that it's easier when you're making a change to eliminate the thing that you're trying to get away from rather than allowing yourself to have small amounts.
We eat today what we ate yesterday, or I guess I should say we crave today what we ate yesterday. So, and people are familiar with this with something like chocolate. If chocolate is getting out of hand in your life, what you discover is that if you can just set it aside for a while, the volume gets kind of turned down a little bit. But if you had it yesterday, then you were going to crave it today at exactly the same time. And cheese is very much that way, or meat. When a person hasn't had it for a while, they kind of forget about it. But if you're reminding yourself every couple of days, you sort of never get away from it, and you never conquer your health problem.
Now, Robin Webb, she was the one who put together these recipes?
Yes.
Yeah, they're really, really, really wonderful and easy. And I just wanted to talk about a few of them. I don't know if you have any particular favorites in here.
Well, there are 125 of them, and
they're all good.
We selected them carefully. Robin and I did this together, and we wanted to make sure that, number one, these are recipes that don't have animal products in them. Number two, we keep oils really low. And number three, they're low sugar, or if I'm talking to a medical audience, I'd say low glycemic index. But what it means is we're not using a lot of white bread and sugar and that kind of thing. They're not low carb at all, but they are completely healthful. And so anyway, are there certain ones that jumped out at you?
Yeah, well, I'm a big oatmeal fan, and you have a spiced pumpkin oatmeal. And that jumped out just because I've got a can of pumpkin in the cupboard from Thanksgiving, and I'm realizing that, wow, this would be a really yummy breakfast that tastes like dessert.
Yeah, and for some people, it's an especially good way to lure them into eating something that they always knew is healthy, but they always kind of thought oatmeal tasted sort of like wallpaper paste, and this is a way to get them back into it. There's a vanilla French toast in there as well. I don't know if you've tried that. But
I see the picture of it, but I haven't tried it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's French toast, and people thought, well, I can't have it. But with a little vanilla flavoring, and it's totally vegan, very healthy, you know, people really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. There's just so many wonderful things. So you've broken it up into breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then there's snacks and entertaining, and you have some menu plans. It's really pretty complete. Okay, the first recipe here that it starts with, I was just, wow, green chili and oyster mushroom crepes.
Mm-hmm.
Really looks, is good. And, you know, people don't realize that they can have, well, you know, I don't even think people eat this way in their regular lives. There's just so much variety in here. And even though these recipes are relatively simple, they're, you could say that they're even gourmet.
They are, but they're easy. And that's really, I think, important. When I'm working with somebody who is thinking, you know, I'd like to do this, but I'm a little unsure how to start, what I'll normally say is, don't feel in any need to change your diet right now. Take a week or so and just open this book, or any of my other books. I have a diabetes book that came out just before this called Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. It's got recipes, too. And I say, take a week or so, see which recipes you like, and either make oatmeal the way I've got here, or you can just make plain oatmeal, boil it up, or throw on some cinnamon and raisins. Find out what you like. And if you have never made spaghetti with just a tomato sauce, let's do that. Or if you love convenience foods, go to the store and get some frozen burritos or a vegan pizza, whatever. Take a week and just find which food you like. Then step two is to do about a three-week period, the 21 days, and try the vegan diet in a test drive for just that period of time. And that's it. Those two steps, at the end of that 3 weeks, people very often feel healthier, lighter, their symptoms are improving, their weight is coming down, and at that point it's easier to think more long term. But I always start up, just browse around, see which ones you like. Don't make any diet changes yet. Once you're ready to make a diet change, do it for 3 weeks. At the end of that time, we'll talk about longer term.
One of the things we like to do at home is, with anything we make, try and make it look really attractive. And I know that people have a tendency to want to do things quickly, and many people are uncomfortable in the kitchen. But anytime we're making a dish, we like to present it really nicely on the plate. And it's not really difficult to do, and the pictures in your book kind of show how food can look really appealing and appetizing, and it makes it, every meal becomes a celebration. The food tastes better when it looks beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. And the foods themselves are beautiful. I mean, let's face it, what we're doing is if you take a cherry or a strawberry or an orange or a peach, these are really little works of art, and what they do in your body is very artistic as well. And when people go out into their garden, they pull these things out, they happen to be beautiful. On the other hand, if people had picked their own pig, or pick your own, instead of pick your own strawberries, pick your own veal calf, and people had to go into a slaughterhouse and see where it actually came from, well, people would be instantly revolted. So those foods are not very attractive, but the foods that are on our palate here are really very beautiful.
You have a recipe for a quinoa timbale. And quinoa is a great grain, ancient grain, high in protein, really quick and easy to make, and it's yummy. And this is a pretty easy dish, but what I like about it is you put it in, you recommend putting them in these individual ramekins and then pressing it and turning it upside down. And what happens is you create something that looks really elegant on the plate.
Yes, it really can be fun, and I think that's important because just as you said, people, the meal doesn't start when something hits your stomach. It sort of starts when the aromas and the looks of the food are sort of say hello to you as you begin the meal, and I think that's the presentation is very important. Now, I've got some exceptions to that. There are plenty of times where you're racing out of the house and you just want to get to work and you know you don't have time for presentation, and that's A-okay. And so that's why our recipes for breakfast are also really fast too. There's plenty of times where you just want to make it quick, and so we're going to make sure that you can.
Absolutely. You include the nutritional breakdown for each recipe per serving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really eye-opening. And I'm kind of thinking that all cookbooks should be a required thing in all cookbooks to see what you're getting in a serving.
Yeah, I always do it. And I think it's really helpful. It's good, obviously, to know that you're not getting any cholesterol at all. That you're not getting any animal fat, that you're getting a really healthy, high-fiber, low-fat, nutritious meal.
And what else did I want to talk about in here? And, of course, a lot of people say when they're struggling, they want a meal plan.
Yeah, well, we do provide meal plans, and we provide them for entertaining and for people of different tastes. But I do want people to also realize that when they're doing this, these foods are tasty. But when you follow them, don't. I encourage people not to modify the recipe in such a way. Well, you know, this pasta would taste a little bit better if I threw some bacon into it. don't do that. Let the recipe speak to you in its own way.
Yeah.
And sometimes the results can be amazing. We had a woman in one of our research studies who we put her on a vegan diet. She was losing weight. She did really well. But in the course of the study, she was at home cooking. And she was making spaghetti, and she cracked open a jar of spaghetti sauce and was pouring it into a saucepan, and she just stopped cold because she discovered that she had never been able to open a jar since her arthritis had been kicking in. Well, her arthritis was gone. She thought, how can that be that this diet has cured my arthritis? Well, we see this all the time. The people have had arthritis for a very long time. In many cases, it's gone. And the most common trigger appears to be dairy products. And when people are no longer having cow's milk products, for many of them, not all of them, but for many of them, their joints just, it's like they're getting younger again. Their migraines go away. So if you were saying, well, this sounds great, but let me have a glass of milk with it, don't do that. Try these foods and see what they'll do for your body.
One of the interesting things is paying attention. Sometimes when we're ill, the pain is so overwhelming, and it's all the only thing you can think about. And when the pain goes away, you don't even realize it. You just feel good.
Yeah.
And then at some point, it's like, oh, I feel good.
Well, usually within about the first 24 to 48 hours of a person going vegan, their digestive tract starts sorting it out. All that chronic constipation is suddenly just gone, and you think, wow, I'm not going by the drugstore anymore to get fiber supplements. And then their energy starts to get better as well. The weight loss usually begins within the first couple of days, although I encourage people to only get on the scale maybe once a week because your weight is sort of like the stock market. You need to see the overall trend. The cholesterol starts dropping. For some people, you see a big effect within even a couple weeks, but I like to give it longer, maybe 10 weeks or so, to really see what it'll do for you. Blood pressure comes down within the first couple weeks. Blood sugar starts getting better. If a person has a huge amount of weight to lose, don't plan on losing it all in the first few weeks. Give it some time, and slow but steady is really the solution for you.
Well, one of the great things about this healthy plant-based diet is that, as you mentioned earlier, you really don't have to count anything. You just know what foods you can eat, and you can eat them. And it's really liberating, I find, and easy.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. I encourage people to think of four food groups: vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes. Legumes means the bean group, beans, peas, lentils. And you can eat unlimited amounts of those in any combinations you want. Keep oils pretty low. And I also should mention that I encourage everybody to take a supplement of vitamin B12.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is B12 is not made by animals or plants. It's made by bacteria. And you need it for healthy nerves and healthy blood. And meat eaters will get some B12 because of the bacteria in a cow's intestinal tract making the B12 that gets into the flesh. And if you're on a totally plant-based diet, you need to have a supplement. Now, that can just be any daily multiple vitamin, which is, frankly, is the easiest way. But it can also be a B12 supplement if you want. You know, the health food stores sell them. But it's important not to miss that you do need to have a B12 supplement of some type.
I think if everyone had a plan that was accessible to them, where all their foods could be prepared for them, that was healthy, we would see a tremendous amount of people moving over to this healthier diet. And a lot of people say it, if it was easy, if it was available. And in some ways it's an excuse, because it is easy and it is available. They just don't see it.
We have published a research study we did with Geico, the car insurance company.
Yep.
And we went into Geico, and we taught people how to do a vegan diet. We had 68 people sign up, and they went vegan. And so you have to say, it's not hard, it's just you may not know where these things are. Where do you eat, sir? Well, I eat at Taco Bell. You know, what are you going to have for me? Well, I'll say, well, if you're eating the meat taco, skip that. Have the bean burrito, hold the cheese, that happens to be vegan.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, if you're at Subway, skip the meat and cheese and load all the veggie toppings onto your sandwich. That's going to be vegan, too. If you're at Burger King, they've got a veggie burger now. So I'm not suggesting that fast food is the pinnacle of culinary art.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. But what I am saying is, whatever you're eating now, there are ways to switch over to a healthier diet that it doesn't take any more time at all, but the benefits are huge.
Yeah, and I guess it's just opening the door to helping people make a transition.
And giving people a few tools. And so that's what we've tried to do in this book, is to say, here's some recipes for you, give it a shot. And if you have the room service gene, meaning you're not going to be doing much cooking, we'll show you how to do it at restaurants and recipes, at restaurants and fast food places, whether or not you use our recipes.
Okay, so we just have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about some of the great things that PCRM has been doing for the last 25 years. And I know that you recently celebrated a 25-year anniversary. I was at the gala in Los Angeles.
Oh, thank you. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did, and I was also at the one in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, both fabulous events. And it's always wonderful to be at those events. Not that we should always be living the glamorous life, but knowing that as a vegan, we can do it all.
Well, I think you deserve to live the glamorous life, Karen. After all that you've done, let's toast to your health. And it was great. Alec Baldwin was our host. And by the way, Alec did a fundraiser for us on the weekend.
This past weekend. Okay.
So he has continued to be a good friend, and there were a lot of celebrities there at the one we did in Los Angeles, as you know. And there's a lot to be done to help people to eat in a healthier way. And we need so very much to get this message out to children right now. Many children are going vegetarian because they don't want to hurt animals, and that's a really good motivation. Many others are environmentalists, but far too many are stuck in the fast food burger, chicken nugget routine, and they're paying a price. The price they're paying is poorer health, bigger waistlines, and they're really limiting themselves. And if their parents can help introduce vegan foods right from the beginning, it's going to be so healthy for all the children who are able to get that benefit.
Well said. And I want to thank you so much. You've been full of such wonderful, wonderful information. You've got every one of your books is great, and this new cookbook, the Get Healthy, Go Vegan cookbook, wonderful, great gift for people that are thinking about going to a healthy diet. And it has a nice, friendly tone to it. You're not being the militant vegan, saying you have to be vegan. You talk about using the word vegan as an adjective, not as someone being a vegan. But
yes, you're not
a
person
diet.
From the planet Vegas. You're eating a vegan meal. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's all very important. People need that gentle nudge to get to a healthy place, not so that they have to feel defensive all the time.
Sure. And don't forget our Kickstart program. It's on our website,
right.
PCRM.org. Speaking of a nice, gentle, friendly nudge, it is the coolest program. It's at PCRM.org.
Okay. Take the Kickstart program today. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for everything that you've done, Dr. Neil Bernard.
Well, thank you. It's been really nice talking with you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so you've been listening to me, Karen Hartglass, and Dr. Neil Bernard of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And I really recommend getting this cookbook. There's just so many yummy, yummy things in it. But then I love food, and everything that I make with healthy plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lots of wonderful herbs and spices, they're all yummy, and they're good for you, and they're gentle on the planet. Do something good for yourself, do something good for your family, and eat more plant foods. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments or questions, you can email me at info@realmeals.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great, healthy week.